So we are just really pleased to have Dr. Asa Lee here today. His first trip to Holden, and you hiked to Monkey Bear Falls yesterday.
I did.
Correct, and made it back, so that was really good. And there's one more chair up here, that'd be great. Except you have to sit by the ice cream eater, so.
She knows it pretty well, so.
Oh, now I get it.
Because she brought a spoon with her. Implicated.
So welcome. Asa is going to be leading this class for 3 days, today, tomorrow, and Thursday, same time, same place. So we're going to give it over to Asa. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sharon.
And we're going to leave the doors open and the window open just for you can,
breathe.
It seldom gets really noisy, so you can control that. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
I'm excited to be here. One of my first rules is always to just kind of know who's in the room. So can we just go around and in this space, your name, where you're from, and how long you've been coming to Holden? Is that okay? Just a second.
I'm Sam. I'm coming from Minneapolis, and this is my third visit over 8 years.
I'm Vicki. I'm from Fargo, North Dakota, and our first visit was 49 years ago in 1969, and so we're here celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary.
Nice.
We're first year here, this our first year of marriage.
I'm Christoph, and I'm one of the products of that marriage. So glad they came here as well. I'm from Minot, North Dakota, but currently moving to just north of St. Paul, Minnesota, in fact, next week. And I was on staff here a few times, been coming about 30 years.
And I'm Rachel. I live in San Luis Obispo, California, and this is my first time at Holden. Mm-hmm. I've been here about a week, a little over a week. So.
Let's go here.
I'm Karen, and I'm from Yakima, Washington. And this is my first time back after 10 years of a week of Abriendo Caminos, which was the Holden week in Spanish. And then 44 years ago, I was pregnant with twins. Here, and the bus broke down on the way down the hill, at least not way up.
I'm Bonnie. I live just north of St. Paul. And this is my first trip to Holden, just arrived yesterday.
My name is Colleen, and I'm from Yakima, Washington, and this is my first trip here.
I'm Carvel. I'm from Yakima, Washington, and this is my first trip.
Wonderful. In the back on the couch. We have a seat up here.
I'm actually just hoping I could just sit here and observe.
Okay. Well, you still have to give us your name and where you're from and how long you've been coming to Holden.
I'm not anonymous. Karen O'Dell from Pullman, Washington.
And this is your first time or how long you've been coming to Holden?
I've been here many times. Okay. Good.
So I'm Helen, and I am from Yakima, Washington, and the first time I came was 1969, and I've come several times over the years, but the last time I was here, I think, was in 2003.
Jim, I'm from Yakima, Washington. I've been here a lot of times. One story that I would tell about Holden. The first time I was here was the library that I discovered. And C.S. Lewis's preface to Paradise Lost was out of print at the time. And I stole it, or borrowed it. I kept it for over 20 years before returning it. And it was back in print when I returned it. I'm still working through the ethics of that. Of that piece.
Yes.
But, I consider myself to be at Holden even when I'm not here. So.
Y'all come on in.
My turn. I'm Colleen. I'm from. Okay, should we wait?
Yeah, no,
that's good. I'm from LaGrande, Oregon. And the first time I came to Holden was 1984. I've been here about 8 times already.
My name is Kate. I'm from Sammamish, Washington, just near Seattle. And I came as a college student in 50 years ago, and I've been back many times with my family and now my graduate.
Let's go here.
I'm John from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. First time here, arrived yesterday.
And I'm Evelyn, also from Milwaukee, and I came yesterday too.
I'm Sarah from Santa Monica, and I came with them yesterday. But I was here last in 1993.
I'm Kay Landsberg, and I am originally from Vancouver, Washington, but have lived in Bozeman, Montana for 30 years. So I have two homes, and came to Holden the first time. We were trying to calculate this because his family invited us non-Lutherans to come. I'm United Methodist, and it was about early 1970s when I was 12 years old, and I've come ever since. So I've been here 25 or whatever. I worked on staff, and I've done the whole thing, and in the winter also at J-Terms and love it, yep.
Yeah, Marvin Landsberg from Bozeman, Montana. Been coming up since 1966. And since my dad was the chair of the board for years, I was like every summer. So that, and I've been on teaching staff here and lots of things.
Yeah. Okay, Doug Hazen. It's my wife, Barb. Talk too, but I'll at the start, but we're together. So yeah, from Silverdale, Washington, and first time to Holden was we're pretty sure it was 1982. Came with our little kids, and been here maybe I don't know, maybe it's 8 times over the years. Mm-hmm. Can add to that.
I don't know what to add. But it was a big break between the first time. We didn't come back for a long, long time, like 2007, 2008, and then we came every year except for remediation. So once we got back, it's like, we're going.
Yeah. I'm Martin, I'm from Vancouver, BC. First time up here was in 2007, 8, I think, something around there. Had a friend on the board who is still on the board, and yeah, I've got to coming up here, and yeah, first time up since my remediation.
And I'm Earl, I'm from Everett, Washington, most recently Yakima, I just moved to Everett. I've been at Holden now for 25 hours.
I thought it was years, but it's hours, it's good.
Yeah, I'm Dick, I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. I was here first in 1971. I was a seminary graduate and there were too many of us and I was single. So the single guys were finding something to do for a while. And it happened to meet my wife that summer here. That's an interesting story. But I was a maverick and we built the laundry that summer. We dug out underneath what was in the hotel and got most of it done. And then I drove buses and I almost thought it was your bus that I was driving when I broke down, but it was a couple of years later.
Coming in,
yes.
Yeah, I'm Julia. I work in the kitchen. This is my first time at Holden.
From where?
Oh, that's kind of a hard question. I guess.
Where you claim? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My name's Charlie. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I work here at Holden. So.
And Hannah, you want to?
I'm Hannah. This is my second time. Me and Samuel here. This is our second time here. And we do a presentation as part of Emmanuel Lutheran Church's anti-racism team in fall or winter. So last time it was snowing.
Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody. Again, my name is Asa Lee. I serve as the Associate Dean for Campus Life at Wesley Theological Seminary, also Professor of Spiritual Formation and Director of African American Church Studies. So I have three very large hats. One is a beanie, but the other two are. And Chuck invited me after having a conversation on the phone about a reference of one of my employees who applied here. After the reference call, he said, you know, I just find you fascinating. Can we talk about you? We talk about the person. That's fine, but can we talk about you now? And by the end of that conversation, he was extending an invitation for me to come. I had never heard of Holden before, but it sounded fascinating to me. Wesley Seminary has had a 30-year commitment to arts and theology, and also a 20-year commitment to eco-justice and creation care motivations, and all of that is wrapped up here at Holbrook. So I kind of said to my president dean, I'm going to Washington in the mountains for a week, and if I disappear, you know, somebody can find me. But I'm excited to be here. I am ordained Baptist clergy. I've been in ministry for 20 years. Yes, I started ministry when I was 16 years old. And so 22 years now. 10 of those have been in ordained ministry as the pastor of a Baptist church in Arlington, Virginia. I stepped down in December and to take on those additional hats at the seminary. And my wife is an ordained United Methodist elder, and she's still active in ministry, so we're a clergy couple. We have four daughters. And the age is 9, 6, 4, and 2, so you can know that. So it's a very quiet household that I have. Yeah, so, but I'm excited to be here to talk about something that is exciting to me. One of the areas I teach in and work with first-year seminary students is a course called Spiritual Formation for the Practice of Ministry. And what that does is it's the prerequisite and the foundational course for all of their field education. And all of it sort of is the class that brings their Bible and their theology and everything together in their person. And what I tell students is that unlike other seminary courses where you have, you know, this textbook that you'll read or that textbook you'll read, the primary text in that class is you. And I'll say the same thing to you all. I'll be referencing a lot of different things, but the primary text for examination is you. Because in Christian discipline and Christian discipleship, the primary text that you should always be reading is you. And the accountability factor and all of the aspects of living life as a Christian are about you living to the expectations of either yourself or of the community or of God and your conception of God. And so with that in mind, what we want to do these next 3 days, and hopefully some of you I know may have to leave or may not be able to, but if we can have a core group of you over the next 3 days, I want to unpack spirituality from a very different place. Most of us in Christian experience, in my experience of working with churches and folks in church, is that discipleship is bifurcated. We separate our discipleship. So we have head, we have heart, and we have hand, right? So, and for better or worse, never the three meet. So what we do with our head in terms of reading or lectures or things we, you know, that edifies us, we grow, but we don't understand how that may inform our heart, right? And we have our passions and the things and our emotional desires to change the world, to do things for justice or what have you, but we don't have a connection between our hands or our mind about how to go about doing that. And in our hands, we, you know, I've experienced, I led 4 mission teams to Haiti. And over again, the mission teams, you know, I have to do a lot of work of connecting their hands with their heart and their head about why we mission, why do we go out and help people in these places. And that's because for many of us, and you may experience this in your own congregations, in your congregational life, is people do the work, but they don't always have an answer to why they do it. Definitely not a spiritual answer, because they don't connect it back to the spirituality. So one of the things that I want to help us to understand is that a bifurcated or separated or fractured spirituality is not what we're called to be as Christians. We are called to be whole creatures before God so that we can be faithful to the command of Christ when he says the law hinges on these two. You must love God with all your, you know that passage? Mind, heart, and soul. You know, regardless of translation, right? Basically those three, mind, heart, and soul. So that suggests a unity, not a fracturing of those things. But, and so what I want to do is first explore our conceptions of spirituality. That's going to be today. We're going to unpack that. We'll have an exercise. We'll do some categorization of that, which may make you uncomfortable, especially if you don't like categorization. Spirituality and categorization don't seem to go hand in hand, but I'm going to blow that apart, and we're going to put them together. And then on tomorrow, we'll look at, in more in depth, a sense of what does this mean for some ideas about living that are not necessarily spiritual, or we wouldn't conceive of as spiritual, like leadership, or study, or, you know, mission, like getting your hands dirty. How is that spiritual? And then on Thursday, my favorite part, I saved the best for last, and that is we'll explore imagination as a spiritual concept. We'll really unpack that spiritual, the spiritual gift of imagination. It's the, I call imagination the spiritual gift that Paul forgot to list in Galatians. Because I think we've done a disservice, particularly in the Protestant church, we've done a disservice to our adherents and to our faithful by getting rid of images and sort of deriding them. And we've lost a sense. We've thrown the baby out of the bathwater. For fear of making idols, we have stripped everything. But there is a place and a role for our imagination in our spiritual life. So hopefully you ride with us, ride together. You're in groups because spirituality is not an individual concept, despite our American proclivities of privacy and individual freedom. Spirituality was never meant to be an individual concept. It's a corporate concept expressed through individuals in a variety of ways. So what we're going to do first, you can talk amongst yourself, but I've got what I call a spiritual typology assessment. It's a big and you're just going to write on it, and it's pretty straightforward. You're going to, let's see, it should be about 4 or 5 at this table. Just follow the directions. You're not turning this in. You can keep it. I don't think I have enough, so I'll run upstairs and make a few more. There should be some pins for everybody, yeah? I need the steps. Let me make some more copies. So, for those who have it, again, you're doing two statements. Please mark up to two statements in each section that apply most to you as you are right now. Not what you aspire to be, but what you are right now. Indicate your first preference as A and your second preference as B. Only two statements per section. And then when you finish, follow directions to tally up on the back side. Okay? I'll be right back for those who don't have them. When adding up the back, of course, on the ones, and it doesn't hurt to ask a question if you're not quite
sure. Well, I don't know how to answer the last one at all. I don't think I've ever been criticized in these ways in a way that I would know.
Then zero.
Okay.
Yeah. Zero is an appropriate response or, you know, negation. Once you finish, circle your highest number. And if you've got a tie, you circle the. If you have a tie for the highest number, circle both of them.
So A's and B's are equal? You said to do both A's and B's? Mm-hmm.
You just tally, you're just tallying up the number of ones, the number of twos, the number of threes, the number of fours. Where you have A or B.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they're equal. Finished, I want you to, with your table, to wrestle with this question. It's a statement that I've heard a lot of times in ministry, particularly when we're in settings in the U.S., you know, doing ministry in the community. And, you know, you say to someone, you know, do you attend church or are you adherent to a faith tradition or something like that. And the response they usually give, or I would hear, and you may have heard this, is I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. You may have heard that before. Right? What do you think, this is the question for your table, what do you think that means when someone says, I'm spiritual, but not religious? Kind of discuss amongst your tables for a few moments. We'll come back to these assessments in just a little bit, give you some more time to finish up. Spiritual, but not religious.
I would hear,
About another 90 seconds. About 15 seconds, bring that last point home.
Too complicated.
Don't start another one. Okay, so what kind of things were you talking about? What kind of things did you hear? Spiritual but not religious. I'm spiritual but I'm not religious. Anybody describe themselves that way? Sometimes when I do that, they say, actually, I do.
Yes, I thought that was a yes or no question.
Oh. Well, if you do, what do you mean when you say it? Yeah.
Well, I understand spirituality as being deeply connected with God, but not in another worldly sense, but deeply connected in life and the world as much as we possibly can. And so, yeah.
Others? Yes.
I see spirituality as being with God, whoever that God is. Everybody has their own definition of that. And against organized religion. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Deliberately against?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Others? Spiritual but not religious.
Our table talked in a few different ways about, here I'll turn around, hearing this from people who maybe grew up in an organized religion or were deeply hurt by that religion, and so no longer willing to identify with that identity because of things, or feeling like maybe moving from religious to spiritual was a maturation or a development. Over time.
Yeah. I've heard that question addressed in our community and to myself. I find it that hearing it, there's a kind of sadness that comes to me in the listening, but that is also a way of another person's saying, I choose not to engage with you mm-hmm. at this time for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And I think I like that. I like it, thinking about it that way, because it sort of destroys, or takes, for me, it destroys the dichotomy of the but, because there's too much unknown on both sides for me. And so when I hear my son say that to me, mm-hmm. it is a direct emotion, mm-hmm. and it's the one that I have deep empathy with.
Okay.
When I hear it addressed to the community, it's much easier for me to feel a certain justification in the person who chooses not to engage in the conversation. Because I think it sets up a situation where, you know, we really aren't able on either side to listen to one another in a listening conversation.
Right. So the thing that is most interesting when I encounter people who say, I'm spiritual but not religious, is what does that mean corporately? What does that mean in terms of how are you engaging a community? Are you engaging a community? And what they typically mean, and this may not be your experience, certainly is mine, is that I'm not engaging an organized faith community. Who said that? Somebody said that, right? That we're not engaging an organized faith community. But then I poke a little bit harder and say, but you are part of a community, right? Well, yeah. You know, I hang out at the pool hall every Friday, or I go bowling, and I got a bowling league, right? Okay, is that your spiritual community? Well, I wouldn't think of it that way. Okay, let me ask you a different question. When your mother died, or somebody died, who showed up to the memorial service? Well, my bowling team came. Oh, they did. Yeah, and then when, you know, we had our first child, everybody showed up, and you know, we celebrated, and you know, it just means a lot to me. And they start speaking in spiritual language about a community that is not Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, but is clearly feeding their spirit. And then I say, you show up, sort of tongue in cheek, you show up religiously for your bowling tournaments, right? Well, yeah. So why is it that the bowling team and the pool hall is not a religious community? Why wouldn't it be? Well, I don't know. I've just never been given permission to think of it that way. Well, congratulations, you now have permission. My point is that our conceptions of spirituality are typically over and against, you know, church or some, right? But we haven't lost our religious spirituality construction. We've just placed it elsewhere. And part of the struggle of our current times is that we want people to come to church. We want people to participate in our organized structures to get what we think they should have. The problem is that people are finding what they need. They're finding God in places. It's the beauty. It's a problem for the organized church. I don't think it's a problem. People are finding God in all wonderful places, right? Tattoo parlors, barbershops, pool halls, places where people gather as people of faith and they organize around these principles. It's not church in the traditional sense. It's not religion as we've understood it, but it's certainly spiritual, right? So what we have to do as Christians is to sort of what you're talking about, which is to open our minds to a broader concept of spirituality, right? To see that we are all spiritual beings operating and we are finding ways to connect and experience God in very different ways. And, I mean, we get that here at Holden, right? You understand that in this place, but it's difficult to understand that when you go back to whatever town or city you're in and your vision is not the same, right? You don't have the grandeur of mountain peaks around you. At least if you're in Yakima, Washington, you might have that, but in Bozeman, Montana. Certainly not in Washington, D.C., we don't have, you know, we have granite, but it's been chiseled. But the idea of spirituality being a much broader concept, and here's the critical piece, a much broader concept than we can define or control. We can categorize it, but you can't sort of narrow it to a particular thing that can be controlled in a way that makes us comfortable, right? That's why Pentecostals always make us a little bit nervous, because they operate in that thing called the spirit, and
Spirit never fits in a box nice and neat.
Yeah. So I can endorse everything that you're saying, but I don't understand how a social organization necessarily has spirituality attached to it under the way you're defining it.
Right. So a social organization does not in and of itself.
Right.
Right? But when I bring my concept of God into a space, say my fraternity meeting, and I believe God is at work when we gather to celebrate the birth of one of the other members' child. Now, I may not overtly pray, but just in my giving of well wishes, I might be conveying a spiritual concept. And I'm introducing this concept into this community. Mm. Right? So the organization itself does not have a spiritual approach. But what I begin to glean from the organization and the community that's gathered, it are concepts that inform my spirituality. That's why a lot of folks that I would encounter in ministry would say, I get more love and support from my Rotary Club meeting than I do when I come to church. Which, as a pastor, breaks my heart. But at the same time, I have to honor that there's something going on in the Rotary Club meeting. So guess where I show up? Can I come and sit in on the Rotary Club meeting and see what the world's going on here? Because all my members are going to the club meeting and nobody's coming to church. Right? What's happening? What's the love that's being conveyed here? Right? That people feel more supported in secular groups. Right? And that support is feeding their spirituality to the point that, you know, I stopped coming to church. Right? And so then instead of me saying steward and shepherd of this organization need to go down there and bust up the meeting because y'all are supposed to be in church, the approach that I take is let's go and listen. What about this is more spiritual than what we ought to be doing in church? So it's redefining our sense of spirituality. Am I making sense to y'all? You know, I'm a Baptist, so I need folks to nod and talk back to me. There you go. So part of what, and the reason why this is important, is because we're living in a time and place where the fracturing of ourselves is having implications for our communities. I think the fracturing that's happening in our society is a product of our own fracturing as individuals. Now, that's a huge theological claim that I'm making, but I just believe that the way in which we think about the world, which can be sometimes so self-centered, how does this impact me and my family and these issues, means that we already begin to separate ourselves from our neighbors, which means we lose the commandment of loving the other half of that commandment, which is love your neighbor as yourself, right? If we bifurcate ourselves, we fracture ourselves, and we lose a sense of that. And so I think key to making whole communities is first making whole beings, unifying ourselves around these concepts. And I'll talk about tomorrow and Thursday a bit more about what that looks like in our communities. But today is all about sort of figuring out who we are and how we might be disjointed or not disjointed in bringing the disjointed parts together. Here's the thing about spiritual. And this is the working premise for these 3 days. Spiritual is not an out-of-body concept. It is not an abstract over there, you know, it's not like an IV shot that, you know, gets injected into your being as a result of praying. You know, I feel the spirit now because I prayed or I sang a song and I get injected with something. No, that's not what spirit means. Spiritual is a deliberately, for Christians, spiritual is an embodied, in-fleshed concept. That's what John's Gospel tells us. That's what we celebrated the Eucharist yesterday. Right? God in fleshed, incarnate. And so if we are to be Christians, then our spirituality has to be embodied in us. And thereby, if it's embodied, then it must be inactive in the world. Again, going to a whole unified. And stop me if I get too theological. Ask me a question. If you don't know what question to ask, just say stop talking for a minute and let me think about what you're saying.
Keep going.
So the
Amen.
It's John's gospel. You can go back and read it on your own, where, you know, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us, right? So the Spirit of God, the Logos of God, becomes enfleshed. In the same way, then, if we are to live as he lived, that's a part of our role, is to enact these concepts and this idea of spirituality as an embodied one. But religious, we typically understand as in the what it's not. When you hear people talk about religious, like most of you define what spiritual is, but you define what religious is by what it's not. Not going to church, being against congregational life, being against organized religion. So we have a more difficult time describing what religious means, right? But if we understand religiosity, religious is a broad concept, much like spirituality. Because we also use the same term for you religiously eat ice cream every Friday, or you religiously eat pizza, or you know, you religiously do a repetitive act. When we think about religious and spiritual, one of the things that these terms clash, because if you're spiritual, then one of the things that you are doing is being open and flexible to whatever the Spirit is doing. So you can't necessarily be religious and be spiritual. Am I making sense? You can be, but they can clash with each other, because if you really are genuinely following the Spirit, you're not going to take the same path twice. The Spirit is always going to move you to a different place, move you to a higher level. It's our own comfort that makes us religious. We like, human beings like repetition. That's why the bulletin is the same every week in your church. Because you want to know where the sermon is and how many things are before the sermon, and when do I need to write my check for the offering, and you know, where are my points? That brings a level of comfort to us. The one time you take away the bulletin, what's happening? What's going on here? We have a service at least once a month where we take the bulletin away. It was not a Sunday morning service, it was a Sunday evening service. You're not going to do that with Sunday morning. But, you know, we take the bulletin away. So folks would come in and they go to the, oh, it's not here. Oh, it's one of these services. Okay. It's just hang on for the ride, right? But what we talk about is that the Spirit is always, and God is always pushing us to the unexpected. And if we get stuck in religious sort of thinking, then we lose the excitement of living as a Christian. Yes.
So, sometimes, I understand exactly what you're saying. I think that is true. But sometimes, it's actually the predictable, the thing, you know, the bulletin is your example.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is what is a little bit more community decided, though, rather than what the particular pastor, you know, is spiritually being moved to say, you know,
right.
Do and say that. So when I think of the word spiritual, I may be totally wrong, but just this idea of it being more me focused,
mm-hmm.
my spirituality, my decision about you know, providing this worship service tonight. It's individual,
mm-hmm.
and the word religious, I think of it as being more community. It can be structured and, you know,
mm-hmm.
go into some of those more negative words that you were just
mm-hmm.
saying, but it, without going too far that way,
mm-hmm.
some of the things that are maybe more positive about
religion mm-hmm.
is that it is a community over time has created
yep.
this combined spiritual expression
yep.
that now is in the bulletin. You
yep.
know what I mean?
Yep.
I don't know.
When I taught undergraduates, one of the working definitions I've used is that religion is a social construction.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a social construction used to provide meaning.
Right.
Right? Politics is a social construction. Education is a social construction. What does that mean? The communities have come together over time, religion in this case, over thousands of years, and constructed this is the system of beliefs that we are going to engage. Right? But what if I don't want to engage all of those? Am I still a part of the religion, or am I somehow kicked out? I was sharing with the group yesterday, the difference between heretics and Orthodox is how many votes you have in Christian history. It's the only real distinction between who's ruled a heretic and who isn't in Christian history. How many votes do you have? You know, Pelagius walked in with not the number of votes that Augustine did, and therefore Pelagius is ruled a heretic in Christian history. And Augustine is lifted up. That's social construction. That doesn't necessarily do with, just because you're heretic doesn't mean you're wrong. You're just not part of mainstream. And so religion is sort of a communal construction that says this is what we're agreeing to. Right? That's what you're saying. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. I'm just defining that that's what it is. But in our society, I can choose to say I'm still a Christian, but I'm not going to do that. Right? That's the spiritual, which, as you define it, might be an individual construction. And if I don't fit in this community, there'll be another community that agrees with me. Right? And I live out my spirituality that way. And we'll call ourselves Christian. Right? That makes those of us in the big family nervous, right? Because we get to point at them and say, no, you're not. Right? Yes?
This might be a slight tangent, but as you all were talking, it just made me think of, especially adding like the framework of time and power and systems of power as well in terms of like how we understand religion. Like I think that that for me is very important to consider, whereas spirituality doesn't seem so bound by those things.
It's not.
Yeah.
Right. And the kind of world we're living in means that we should be doing more work around the spiritual and not necessarily religious. Mm-hmm. Now, I say that as one who is preparing people, my livelihood and vocation is preparing people to steward the religious expression, right? To manage and to shepherd flocks of people who are coming to exercise their spirituality through the religion. Mm-hmm. See that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, I understand I'm in a paradox, whatever, I got a therapist for that. But but the reality is that we don't talk enough about broader definitions of spirituality. The problem that we have in the church, and this is the problem, and I do mean it as a problem, is that we confuse our religion with spirituality. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That if you don't go to church, if you don't participate in the organized religious struggle, you're not spiritual. Right? And that is the issue. That's the problem. Because you can be both. Right? But they're not synonymous. Right? Yeah.
I would just add to that I feel like I sense a lot of people who are religious about church attendance,
right,
who assume that a spiritual encounter is always going to happen, or that like because somebody intones scripture, it gets heard.
That's right.
You know what I mean? And then, and I want to sort of, I think that's a growing edge for, nope, that's a labor. You know, that's something you improve at and you work at, and you can religiously focus on being,
right,
you know, helping the spirit to stir in those aspects of your worship.
Absolutely. Said differently, church attendance is not Christian discipleship.
So, so religion, social construction,
right?
Get that. I mean, gender, you know,
okay,
everything. So, but spirituality is socially constructed, isn't it?
Socially understood.
I would even say, I mean, once you have
say more about the construction.
Or,
yeah.
Once you have a word for it, language is a social. So we're already socially constructing a thing. I mean, I don't think you have spirituality as the neutral God flow and everything else. I mean, I think both of them are socially constructed.
So I would say not constructed but understood, because I may present a spirituality that doesn't fit anybody's construction, right? And just because I name it doesn't mean I've constructed it. It's just I'm experiencing it. And me experiencing it myself doesn't mean that the community has constructed it, right? Let's take, for example, in West Virginia, you have something, and I've been to a church, you have snake handlers, right? The practice is one that's been passed down, right? And it's organized. And so you have to be, and there's a rule for it. And nobody can just walk up to the altar and grab a snake, because you'll get bit, and then they're going to look at you like, what's the matter with you? Why would you walk up to, right? But it's only under the unction of the Holy Spirit. And there are all sorts of rules for that, right? Now, mainstream denominations say, y'all are not a part of us. But the practice that they have is rooted in the Bible, in the Old Testament, where under the Spirit of God, the Levitical tribe were able to grab snakes and handle them. Right? Well, that's a lot more biblical than some of our other mainstream Christian practices, which we don't know why we do them, because they're not in the Bible, right? So that's a social construction, but the way that it comes about doesn't fit any of the models, right? So it comes from a place that is rooted in a social construction, but is extended beyond that. If I do something and say, you know, I experience the Spirit of God in making quilts, right? Is that a social construction? Probably not. But the experience might be defined through a social construction, using the Bible, using some other means. So I would say that it's the explanation, right, not so much the construct itself. Yeah.
Well, I'm going back to another statement. The one about discipleship. Say it again.
Church attendance is not church discipleship, Christian discipleship.
Can it be?
It can if the adherent is doing the work on their own. To
okay,
inculcate.
So I want you, so just flesh that out, because I think they can go together. But go ahead.
They can, but the onus is on the individual church attendant who takes the sermon each week or takes the lesson each week and enacts it in some sort of way, right? The purpose for church attendance is to reconnect and reengage their own spirituality. But it only flows from the adherent that way. Just going to church is not Christian discipleship. Right?
How are you defining discipleship then? Because one would think that you would enhance your discipleship by going to church.
You would enhance it, but it is not the core. In other words, if I go to church and the sermon is on forgiveness, or the sermon is on hospitality, And I say this from my experience as a pastor. We preach on hospitality. Before the coffee hour is over after church, someone has been inhospitable to one of our guests. But if I said to that person, hey, you took the last bagel. You know, that was not very nice. You know, you could have, well, they can go to Dunkin' Donuts. What, didn't you? Didn't we just talk about hospitality? Like, 20 minutes ago, did we just talk about being open and hospitable to somebody, right? Oh, well, yeah, but, you know, you did talk about that, didn't you? Well, sorry. All right. Now, I'm being facetious, but I'm kind of coloring an actual situation that's happened, right? That person sat through the entire worship service, heard the word, but never made the connection between their own spirituality and their opportunity to practice that spirituality in the same building.
But your intention was for them to enhance their discipleship, right? As a preacher.
My intention was that they would take the lesson and embody
it.
Exactly. Right?
Okay.
Right? So that's what I mean by church. Christian discipleship is not church attendance.
Okay.
Right? That person has to see themselves as being a part of that process to which the worship is an expression of, but not the only. Does it make sense?
Yes. Like you can log into a library and not read. You know, like, you know what I mean? Like you can go into a place that's full of the expectation of literacy and
But I guess I'm making a distinction with the intention of all of us gathering for worship,
mm-hmm,
is to develop ourselves as disciples. I mean, that's one of the intentions for me.
But you can not engage. Like you can just sit there.
Right. Sure. You don't have to. But okay.
Yeah. But you're actually making that very point.
Yeah.
Is that
right.
You know, you're starting in the same place I am. The hope and intention of Christian worship,
yeah,
is that we gather
as,
together
as disciples.
As disciples. But what often happens is that we become complacent. Some become complacent, and they gather out of routine and not out of expectation, right? My hope is that every single person that comes to worship as a Christian disciple is expectant that God is going to do something to renew their journey.
Yeah, and I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt on that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, 20 years of ministry makes me cynical. I will confess that. One back here and then two.
I was just going to say, I think maybe now what we need to do is have more deep listening to the minister when he talks, or when she talks, or when we maybe we don't listen deeply enough.
Well, we don't even listen to each other.
I know.
In worship, right? And many times, as the pastor preaching, I wasn't always concerned about whether they're listening to me, right? Are they listening to the Spirit of God at work in the community, right? Because a lot of times, the best preaching comes in the pew between individuals. But we don't even listen to each other. Our churches are designed to listen to the guy or gal sitting up front, right? They're not really built, some sanctuaries, but not too many are built facing each other. Quakers do that, though, right? Yeah.
I was going to say that if worship gets to the point where you're checking the box for the week and say, well, I did that church thing, and it's like the holy inoculation that, you know, okay, now I'm good for the week.
There you go. Yeah.
And I think that's when it turns into rote and is not equipping disciples for being disciples. I think a lot of purpose of the church attendance is to renew and refresh.
Right.
And bring you back to the point where I'm ready to go out and be in the world and communicate the message.
Yep.
By Thursday or Friday, you're like...
Especially if you've been doing work, right? Yeah. You've been helping people or forgiving folks. And,
yeah.
You know, but it all starts with you as a disciple. Richard.
I totally hear this, and I also just want to say that, like, I think too, sometimes I have felt like the church doesn't always engage, like, myself.
Absolutely.
Like, I feel like I want to go to a church that has social justice teaching. I want to hear about the gospel. I want to hear about, what we are called, like, how we are to live. Like, even political issues, like, I want those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel, or even, like, being a young person, is my voice welcome? Like, am I allowed to really fully participate? So I think I just want to bring that frame into this as well. Like, I think it's so important as what we do and how we come as well. But mm-hmm. also, like, is the church serving its purpose? Like, are we responding to the times? So, I don't know.
Yes, it's both and,
mm-hmm.
right? It's both and. That the challenge is that the church is made up of the individuals.
Yeah.
Right? And so getting the individuals to understand their individual responsibilities as disciples means that when we come together as a corporate body, I put my responsibility with your responsibility, and we begin to figure out what our corporate responsibility
and collaboration
is and work together in that. And that's what community is all about. And that's where the challenge is. Many times we get more collective responsibility and unity from the non-church places than we do in our congregations. You know, as a Christian, I strongly believe that the mandate for the changing and the transformation of the world is a really lofty statement, but I still believe it. Despite my cynicism, the transformation of the world belongs to the church. That's my Christian claim. If anybody else wants to do that with their own religion, that's fine too. But I believe the transformation of the world through discipleship making belongs to the church. That's a huge responsibility.
Amen.
Right? But I believe that God has given us the corporate body in the presence of Jesus Christ, in the body and blood and resurrection of Jesus Christ, that mandate. And so, if our churches aren't transforming our communities, thereby transforming the world, then we're failing our responsibility. But I don't believe, and I never preach, that it's the church, capital C, as an entity that's somehow disembodied from the 50, 100, 200, 300 people that gather on Sunday. Church is people. Right? So, you know, being able to say, this church is going to change this community, when you decide, as the individual, to give yourself over more fully to the work of Christ in this community. So, with that being said, though, what I want to do is sort of turn quickly back to spirituality, right? And get us to think about ourselves, we're the text, and our own spiritual practices. How many folks have ever thought about their spiritual practice and where they fall on the scale? What feeds your spirit? Right? And what doesn't feed your spirit? Right. So this assessment you just did was done by the Alban Institute eons ago. The Alban Institute's now gone, but the typology is still really good. The survey is really meant to get you to locate yourself. Even if you don't fall on the spectrum, that's information. Even if you don't like the assessment, that's also information. You know, sometimes I have one or two students say, I just can't do this because, you know, and that's fine. But then that's also information to take in. How do you experience God? The goal of this is to measure and give you a sense of where you are and what feeds your spirit as a point of departure. Because all of us are always being transformed and always being recreated by the Spirit of God, we don't always stay in the same spot. And so knowing where you are will only inform you, this is good for this environment, knowing where you are will only inform you where you'd like to go, where you want to go, and what the next place for you to go is. So, with that being said, I've passed around, this is one for the table, and I'm going to use the colored one, so I'll stand over on this side, because he partners with y'all. So, you'll see, and you've got one at your table, so, that this is a whole spiritual being. The circle being infinite, never ending, is a whole spiritual being. To the vertical is more intellectual. That is, you experience intellectually stimulating. And then to the south or to the bottom is more heart-centered. Right? To the my right, your left, is mystical. Those practices that sort of are non-concrete, but offer a mysterious presence, things like incense, candle lighting, vagueness, darkness, those kind of things. And then to the left here is concrete expressions, hard concrete realities, objects, icons, physical manifestations, crucifix, cross, those are experiences. So you've added up your ones, twos, threes, and fours. What the assessment says that if you are a one, then you experience God through sort of a intellectual and concrete experience. So you're given concrete experiences to reflect on. Right? You do a thing, and then you relive it or experience it in a concrete way. I'm going to read the actual explanation. I wrote these down so that you wouldn't. So if the number of choices that you had, how many folks had the highest number being ones? Okay. So then understanding God as Father, Mother, the centrality of Christian incarnate, symbol and sign are important aspects of your faith. Folks in this group seek concrete aspects which will help them in their Christian life in the real world. So you always, you're not necessarily a feeler, is what a one is. They tend to need to think through, right? The worship has to make logical sense in some way. That's what a one would be. A high one. What's the number? What's your, is that?
I'm tied with that in two.
Okay.
I'm 5544.
Oh, yeah, so you're the blue blob. You're the blue blob, right? But that's a one. A two is a heart-feeling spirituality, right? And so God is still expressed in a concrete theology in Scripture. It's still central, but now there's a more focused aim on feeling. Personal transformation and renewal are key, with an emphasis on the experience of God, a shared experience of God, that might involve, for example, testimony or music or things that you feel something as a part of the spiritual expression. Twos. Who are the twos in the room? Is that about accurate? Anybody a strong two, high number?
Six.
Six?
Is that high? Yeah.
Compared to the others?
Yeah. Well, I got a five on another one.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, Jim. High, pretty high?
Pretty high.
Okay.
Not the highest.
Okay. Threes. Soul, mystical, spirituality. This is feeling and hearing spirituality. You seek to hear from God rather than speak to God.
Amen.
The aim is the union with the holy, and even though it may never be fully achieved, the journey itself is good enough for your spiritual experience. Contemplative in nature and focused on the inner self is really important for threes. Who are the threes? It's kind of what I was thinking.
Holden Village.
Big and Holden. All right, threes. Yeah. And then fours are... hands-on spirituality. These individuals are often seen as visionaries, single-minded, deeply focused. Your aim is simply to obey God and bring about the reign of God in very particular ways, using your hands and giving them over to God. Missionary. Fours. Also kind of what I was thinking with Holden Village. Threes and fours. Yeah. Anybody have, we're all close together. Yeah, all. So, what tends to happen, and when I do this, and I've done this for at least 6 years, is that we migrate. It depends on the phase of life we're in, right? It's interesting, I had a group of pastors do this, and one of the pastors lost their spouse and ended up taking a long stint from ministry back in ministry. When they came to ministry, they were strong ones, right? Lining up, theology sound, everything lined up. And then when her husband died, she was 7 months pregnant with their second child, and she was pastoring, and ended up... he had cancer and was dying very suddenly. She went, over time and is now much more of a three. Because that wilderness experience, as she described it, became the place where she realized that logic and thinking about the structures of who God is really didn't get her anywhere in that wilderness experience. But she felt God's presence in mystical ways. And so your life journey is going to shape that, but also your intention of experiencing God is going to shape where you are on the spectrum. So what I charge folks with is if you are a one, then why don't you start moving a bit to see what a four might look like in your life.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to do that. But... again, this is about expanding your definition of spirituality. Why is that important for communal living? Because we have problems talking across the quadrants. The kind of worship that a one is going to experience in church is not going to be what a three wants out of the worship experience. But yet, both are in our congregations. And if we're not talking to each other, then we start breaking down the community. Worse yet, in some places, we start valuing one over the other. So, if you guys are just going to go in a room and light candles and incense, man, that ain't Jesus, right? Wait a minute. Let's not call each other names. What are you getting out of that experience? What is happening? Can I sojourn with you? As a Baptist, I have... when I answered my call to ministry, I was so confused. And I grew up lifelong Baptist, and Baptists don't have a very good system of discernment. you know, when you answer a call to ministry. You essentially go to your pastor and say, I think I'm called. And they say, okay, go sit down for a little while, pray, and then come back to me in 6 months. And if you still answer yes, then we'll talk about it. Right? And that's essentially your discernment process. And then they say, go to seminary, and then come back, and we'll look at licensing at some point, and maybe get you prepared for ordination. So when I answered my call to ministry, I was serving as a music minister, working with a church, minister of worship, that kind of thing, and the pastor was my boss. And so I went to them, and they kind of gave me that spiel, go back in 6 months. And so, you know, in 3 months, I said, I don't think I'm supposed to be doing any of this. And so I left the church and went on a sojourn. I went to Pentecostals, I went to Episcopalians, just visiting churches, trying to understand. And I was very much a one at the time. And as I moved from a one, when I got to the Pentecostals, I experienced a three in a way that I had never experienced it before. I always thought Pentecostals were crazy folks who say crazy things and they holler and jump around. But I went to the Pentecostal church and I realized that there is an experience and there is a feeling. And I couldn't understand it. And I couldn't make sense of it. And so, what is that all about? I'm still a one, but I'm more in this sort of closer to the center now. You know, I also understood leading mission trips, the power of God when you're doing the work, when you're physically using your hands and moving, right? Now, I must say that I wasn't intentional about any of those moves. But I was open to the Spirit of God working in my life in such a way that if this is where I needed to go, then wow. Right. No resistance. Well, maybe so. but being willing and open to allow God to move me through whatever cycle I'm in. Because now I can understand what Pentecostals are doing. I can understand people who are on mission trips. I can understand it. And that becomes the place of communal relationships. Right? That's where we begin to build the community that can potentially change and will change and transform the world through making disciples of Jesus Christ. Yes?
So this really has a lot of applications. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. You know, you're talking about yourself as a young pastor, and I completely identify with that. I do everything when I was.
Right.
I knew what Lutherans were supposed to believe, and I know what sin was. Boy, when I left my first parish, they said they learned a lot about sin when I was and it totally changed by to the other end, but I'm retired mm-hmm. because I've learned over the years not what I know, but what I don't know.
Right.
And what I don't know opens my life to new experiences and to be surprised, hence mystical, in a sense. What I see us doing in the church a lot of times is we I think especially professionals choose one of those others. Okay, I'm with it. Sure enough.
Right.
And we really get after each other, or else we don't say anything, but you know, shake our heads. But I think there's just a lot of application there that's extremely helpful.
Yeah. The operating premise is that we are spiritual beings. Created in the image of God, here on earth, to bring the good news of Jesus Christ,
yeah.
which is the transformation of the world.
Yeah.
Not Christendom, right? Not under a banner of a type of Christian, but changing the world for Christ. So then, if that's the case, that change has to start with each one of us. And that means understanding our spiritual practices in such a way that they inform our life and alter who we are. This is why we have a warping, because we don't do this, I think, this is again my bias, I have a soapbox, if you haven't noticed. When we don't do this, the implication is that we misunderstand our Christian faith, and worse yet, we pervert it, and cause confusion and chaos, I think, because people do not understand, you know. I live in Washington, D.C., and so The two things you don't talk about in Washington, D.C. is your politics and your religion. Which is why both of them are so screwed up in Washington, D.C.
Wait a minute.
The idea is, because you don't want to offend anybody, right? We have to live together, and you know, you might be at a cocktail party or something, and they work for the administration, whatever administration that is, and you just offended your host, or you offended, right? But there is a sense that our Christian witness should be transforming our lives, and thereby transforming each other. And when we don't speak from that place of conviction, I think we miss the opportunity to show people the power and love of God. You know, if evangelical, say it this way, evangelical is not a bad word. It has been stolen from us by political forces, but it's not a bad word. And so when people say, well, you know, are you evangelical? Absolutely. You mean you get up on Sunday and you start spouting that stuff like Jerry Falwell? No, that's not evangelical, that's political speech, wrapped up as religious conviction. What is evangelical? Spreading the good news of Jesus Christ. That's all it is. And what's the good news? He lives, right? And he's changing the world each and every day when we do this. So I think, you know, that starts with a radically different view of our spirituality. The reason why I titled these sessions is Reawakening Prophetic and Spirituality is because it's there. For each one of us, there are elements of this spirituality that are already a part of us. We haven't yet been given permission to live from the inside out. We've been told to conform to whatever the religious norm is in our given community. And what I want to challenge us to do is to light the fire again. To be prophetic in the sense of holding one another accountable in Christian love. And to be imaginative, that doggone it, this little white box is not enough. That there's something greater happening in the world than what we're part of. I'm going to stop talking. Are there questions, comments, reactions to this verse? Yes?
I found it interesting that the experience of music was specifically called out under Category 2. Those of us who sing in choirs and are part of organizations that have an active music ministry and pride ourselves in that, I've been sort of chewing on that as a, it's like, well, are we doing music in a hand action sort of way? Mm-hmm. And is it the act of making music or the experience of music that is what it is that it's doing for us? I think for me, it's kind of more on the foresight, but I can see how it would also be too.
It's very, very good observation. You know, as a musician, I found that the more that I worked in church as music, as a music minister, the less the music spoke to me spiritually. That was just my own journey of spirituality. Because I was in charge of crafting the worship services, right? So I began to know instinctively what a piece would do to the room, right? Well, then, you know, it could be a one, but it also could be a four. But what I realized is what I needed was a three.
Exactly.
I wanted to be surprised by God. I wanted to experience and feel the mysticism. But if I was planning the worship each week and, right, the music didn't, so then I had to find other ways to experience that, right? But I didn't know that at the time, right? So I'd end up leading two worship services on Sunday morning and then going to the Catholic church where they used incense and have an incredible sort of out-of-body experience in 45 minutes in Mass. And I didn't know what they were talking about. You know, stand up, sit down, whatever. I'm Baptist. I don't know all that stuff. But that's where I experienced God, not on my job, right? But I didn't know that until later. So being aware of that helped me to understand, okay, I'm not getting what I need here. What I need is this kind of experience. So yeah, you know, you think it's one thing in worship, but actually it might be something else. And knowing that tug and pull is really important. Yeah.
When you talk about transgressing between quadrants,
uh-huh.
you know, I think one thing I found really helpful is the body barometer, and just witnessing people in a congregation, and when people are really uptight, and they don't know that they're totally demonstrating their uptightness, you know?
Right.
Or like, you just look around a congregation, and just feel pity for that preacher, because, you know, it's just a bunch of people looking at iPhones,
yeah.
You know, it's like so clear that they're
it's
not activated.
Either.
Yeah, you know, and it may not be part of that tradition,
right?
That's Lutheran, but still, there's a body barometer that if you can sort of get, once you sort of get attuned to your own, like, oh, wow, I'm really angry. That might not be all bad. Maybe I need to question that. Maybe I need to sort of deal with that. Maybe now's not the moment, but, ooh, I got pretty three there, or I got pretty...
Yeah. And that's good for those of us who lead and participate in worship services, you know, to understand that it's not the whole worship that speaks, but there may be elements of the worship that
mm-hmm.
speak to the spirituality of individuals. Right, so the most powerful moment in the church that I served was the passing of the peace.
Mm. Yeah.
That was the most powerful, in many churches, that's the most powerful moment. You know, I joined that congregation was often accused of not being loving by one of the senior pastor. Mm. And so one day after service, I said, that's just a bunch of crap. Because when people tell the story of how they came to this church, they don't talk about how they met the person in the grocery store and, you know, they showed me love. They talk about when they visited, they felt love at the passing of the peace, which in our case happened in the middle of the worship service. So the very placement of the passing of the peace just sort of bookended everything about the service. And the way that we talked about that was, okay, we could change anything else in the worship service. We cannot change the passing. They will kick all of us out if we do away with the passing of the peace. But that was the moment where everybody moved, and you see folks go from the balcony to the front pew and go back to the balcony. But it was the energy that was conveyed that allowed for that expression that that's what people connected to, right? So that was the body barometer for us, is that you could get people really engaged in the worship of the passing of peace.
Yeah, I to follow on with this, I think, there can be a lot of conflict about the ways that worship gets done,
mm-hmm.
right? Even in an organization like the Lutheran Church, which has lots of nice little skeletons to hang things on. but I like this is giving me some language to kind of to listen better to
mm-hmm.
when people are maybe making a complaint or a concern expressed, to kind of understand, oh, where is they? It sounds like maybe they, for them, they need something of this in the service. And maybe you can't design or co-create a service that works for everybody, but you can bring more awareness to the way that elements happen.
Yes.
So thank you.
Yeah.
I guess that was a long thank you.
One of the ways that happens is the way the liturgist introduces, right? You know, when I counsel pastors and congregations about their worship leadership, I tell them all the time that whoever the liturgist is has to be trained in such a way to introduce each element of the worship service. One of the things that's annoying to visitors is it's on the bulletin, but I don't know what that means. You know, I don't know what passing the peace means.
Intention. You know what that means, right?
Certainly. I went to Methodist seminary and an Episcopal seminary. And the first time the chapel elder said in my first worship service, we will do communion by intention, I was like, I already been baptized. Right? So, you know, we had to tell the chapel elder, you know, when I became dean, I had to tell the chapel elder, please explain intention. We're almost 50% non-Methodist to know what intention means. But, you know, it does a lot for the ones to explain communion, right? What is happening in this table? Before you even get to the Great Thanksgiving, what are we about to do, right? It's a part of the invitation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's, you know, and I don't mean the liturgical language. I mean vernacular. It's one thing to say Christ invites all to this table, okay? Does that mean two?
Yeah.
I'm not a member here. Does that mean, right?
Yeah.
You know, right? But, for example, last night, that was wonderful. You don't need to be a member, right? You don't need to be a Christian, right? Vernacular helps to explain. The ones in the room, okay, this is what we're about to do. And then when I experience it, I might be looking for something as a one. You know, the threes are sitting there saying, can we just get to it. I'm excited, I'm ready. Right? but that includes everybody in space, right?
Yeah.
So when I train ministers, I always say to them, everything you say from that pulpit should be invitational. And prepare people for what is coming next. It is now time for the offering. This is the moment in time in our church service where we tangibly give back to God. In the Old Testament, you did not worship God until you gave a gift. And our New Testament understanding is we give ourselves. However, grace is free, but ministry costs. So in this case, while we all receive the grace of God, we invite you to give as God has given to you. A portion of what you've received, right? That 20 seconds prepares the people for what they're going to do collectively, right? Mm-hmm. And that way, when we walk away from service after the benediction, I know what I've participated in, and it has meaning for me, right? That's a huge element towards unifying all of that. But many of our services, we go and we start, you know, let us read the call of worship, and then we check everything off the list, and those of us who know, and those who don't, you're late to stand up or sit down, you know? And I've been to enough worship services where I've been the guy. What are we doing next?
Yeah.
What's happening? Mm-hmm. All right, so. Anything else? Well, thank you all for this first session. I'm excited. I hope you got something out of it.